Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this next hour is fascinating man and longtime friend, Joseph Pierce. Joseph is well known as a Catholic writer, teacher, lecturer, and many of his works have become quite popular, such as his works on Tolkien, especially with the popularity and great success of the trilogy films. But it's his biographies of C.S. Lewis, of G.K. Chesterton, his work on the great poet and translator Royal Campbell, other Catholic literary figures in books such as Literary Giants, and books like, I think it's called Literary Converts, isn't that right?
Yes.
So we have a long list of books that Joseph Pierce has written, but we want to talk today about his most recent book, which is autobiographical. He calls it a conversion story rather than a memoir, and we'll find out why very quickly. The book is entitled Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love, and is published by St. Benedict Press in North Carolina. Joseph himself lives in South Carolina with his two children, his wife Susanna, outside of Greenville, but teaches now in New Hampshire at the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, where he is writer in residence and professor of humanities. He taught at Ave Maria University for many years before that. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be on, Dale.
This took a lot of guts for you to write. I mean, basically, you're telling a story of a young man growing up in England who fell into basically what we know as the skinhead mentality. The you were against immigration, you were against the pollution, I guess, of the English culture and bloodstream. Your father had raised you to love Old England and Shakespeare and the Queen. And you just didn't like what was going on in the England that you were growing up in. You were born in 1961, so this was all going on in the late 70s. You were getting involved in organizations such as the National Front. You had founded, I believe, a rag called Bulldog and were writing for it, which ended up landing you in jail twice, once for 6 months, once for a year. So you really have quite a story to tell. By the way, did you ever shave your head?
Yes, once or twice.
So, I mean, here you are. You know, you've established yourself in America. You're quite well known and respected as a writer and expert on literature, Shakespeare, Tolkien, other Catholic writers. And all of a sudden, you sort of drop this bomb in the middle of your reputation, talking about your very sort of unsavory background. Why did you do that?
Well, a couple of things. I think it needed to be said, first of all. I obviously have a skeleton in my cupboard, and it seems to me there are two things you could do with a skeleton in your cupboard. You can lock it away, hide the key, and hope no one finds it, but then spend the rest of your life living in fear that someone will. Or you can take the skeleton out and rattle it around in front of everybody so they know and see it. So that was one reason, if you like, to make a clean sheet of things. And the other reason was that I think it's a story that needed telling. I'm hoping it's going to edify and inspire, and maybe, hopefully, God willing, bring other people to Christ and His church through the realization that no one, however far they appear to be from the love of Christ in their own sinful lives, no one is beyond the reach of God's grace, because, you know, if that grace can reach me, it can reach anyone.
Not beyond a skinhead. Now, I'll be honest with you that, you know, first of all, I want our listeners to know, I'm talking to Joseph Pierce about his recent book, Race with the Devil, where he talks about how he got converted away from the racial hatred that he was not just filled with, but was actually writing about and promulgating. You have told me about this before. I don't remember whether or not you told me privately or on a previous radio show or what, but it's not like something you were hiding from anybody. So, but I want our listeners to know that. But secondly, it reminded me a lot of 2005 and the explosion over the immigration debate. If you recall down in 2005, the right wing of the conservative movement and even the Republican Party went absolutely crazy over proposed immigration reform. And I was following this at the time as a Catholic journalist, and I was actually finding out-and-out racial smears toward Hispanics. And I was very surprised that a lot of people that I respected were falling into this kind of race-baiting language. Did you see any parallels in that during that period?
Yeah, absolutely. What we find, you know, you can start off with a legitimate question. For instance, was the British Nationality Act of 1948, which basically, if you like, opened the gates for mass immigration to the United Kingdom, particularly from the Indian subcontinent, from India and Pakistan, and also from the Caribbean, was that a good act to pass? No, I don't think it was. I think it was very ill-advised, and it's led to the balkanization of British culture and to the many, many, many problems related to that multicultural experiment now in the UK. So was that a good act of Parliament to pass? No, it wasn't. Was it a disaster ultimately for Britain? Yes, it was. But there's no excuse at any time for a Christian to hate his neighbor, to hate his brother, or even to hate his enemy. So the point is that once we fall into racism, we're already falling into the losing side. We're on the wrong side the moment we succumb to racism.
Of course, you tell that story. I'm talking with Joseph Pierce about his recent conversion story / memoir, Race with the Devil. You talk in your book about how Chesterton was key in opening your eyes. Now, everyone should realize as they listen to you that you had been in jail for 6 months. You had just been resentenced for another year for breaking a law against what would the law have been against? Joseph?
Well, it's a hate crime.
Hate crime.
It's illegal under Britain's Race Relations Act to publish material deemed likely to incite racial hatred. And my editorship of that magazine, Baldwin.
And would you say that you were guilty of that at the time?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, although I denied it at the time, in all honesty, that the purpose of Bulldog was to do everything possible to destroy the multiracial experiment by stirring up hatred between the races. So I think it would be
guilty as charged.
Guilty as charged, yeah.
How did you find G.K. How did G.K. Chesterton get into your hands in the midst of all that?
Of course, at the time, I was extremely anti-Catholic as well as being a racist, so I wasn't.
Yeah, you were involved in the Protestant Catholic ongoing struggle in Northern Ireland, and you were on the Protestant side.
Exactly, very, very. But, you know, again, I think we need to make it clear that I was an agnostic, so I don't want to liken myself to being a Protestant as a believer, because I wasn't. You know, the so-called religious conflict in Northern Ireland is a question of tribalism. It's two tribes basically, and I was with the Protestant.
Not really. It's not really about religion, is what you're saying.
Exactly. It's not about religion. It's basically about territory. It's about whether the northern six states of Ireland should be part of the United Kingdom, whether they should be part of the Republic, and that's a political struggle. The two tribes are divided along, should we say, tribally religious lines. But I was not religious. I was an agnostic. I didn't care about religion, but I was an anti-Catholic, and therefore was accepted by the Protestant tribe over there. So I was very anti-Catholic, and I wasn't therefore in the least bit interested in reading anything religious, and certainly not anything Catholic. So I would not have read Chesterton because he was a Catholic author. I read Chesterton because I was interested in alternatives to, shall we say, international communism and should we say globalism.
You got interested in the distributism.
Exactly. It was the politics and economics, because I was interested in, should we say, third paths between the extremes of sort of global, for want of a better word, capitalism on the one hand and globalism on one hand and international communism on the other. I thought I refuse to accept that these are the only two sane alternatives. Well, they're both insane. The only two alternatives for the future of humanity. So I was interested in politics. But, of course, you start reading Chesterton, and everything Chesterton writes is interwoven in some way with his religious faith.
Yes.
I became open and susceptible to Chesterton's Catholicism.
So he had a serious worldview operating in his writing.
Exactly, a serious worldview, which, of course, once you realize that, you transcend mere politics, mere policy, and even mere ideology, and you start going deeper into the realms of philosophy and theology.
So I'm very curious myself, and I think some of our listeners would be who perhaps know a little bit about Chesterton's authorship. Where in Chesterton did you start, and then at what point did you start bumping into these other aspects of Chesterton?
Well, I started bumping to the other aspects immediately because the book I started on, well, there are two books. One was The Outline of Sanity, which is Chesterton's basically economic book. So that's one thing. But the other book, someone said I needed to read one particular essay of Chesterton's, which is an essay called Reflections on a Rotten Apple, which was in a book of Chesterton's essays called The Well and the Shallows. So I bought the whole book in order to read that one essay, which is about two-thirds of the way through the book. But I began reading it from page one. And the rest of that book is a defense of the Catholic Church against various modern attacks upon her. So the Church, in the book's title, The Well and the Shallows, the book was the well, that which was deep and life-sustaining, and the shallows were the various alternatives to it. So right from the very beginning, I was, if you like, confronted and up to a point affronted by Chesterton's Catholicism, but I couldn't help liking the man, and I couldn't help liking most of what he was saying. So bit by bit, even the Catholicism became attractive to me.
And so this reading, was this done in jail or before you went to jail the second time?
I started reading Chesterton before I went to jail the second time. So that's why by the time I went to jail the second time, I was confused because...
You were a little meek and milder, I guess.
Yeah, well, basically, when you go to prison, you know, one of the things that they do, it's called, at least in the UK, it's called processing. So they ask you a lot of questions. So, you know, are you a drug addict? Do you have certain diseases? Are you an alcoholic? And one of the other questions they ask you is, what's your religion? And they asked me that question, and I wasn't expecting it. It took me by surprise, and sort of on the spur of the moment, I said, Catholic. And then as soon as I said that, I thought, what have I said? Because I'm not a Catholic.
Right.
But I didn't correct myself. So consequently, as far as the prison system was concerned, I had a red label outside my cell, which signified the fact that I was a Catholic prisoner. So in other words, by the second prison sentence, Chesterton had softened me enough towards Catholicism that when asked that question, that's actually how I identified myself.
Now, so you had this label or this color outside your cell. Does that mean that clergy started dropping by?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Catholic chaplain started to visit me frequently. He was young and wet behind the ears. I don't think he really knew what to do with me.
He was dealing with this skinhead reading Chesterton.
Exactly.
He must have been completely perplexed.
I certainly wasn't a fully committed Catholic. I certainly wasn't a convert at that time. I was en route, obviously, but I wasn't there. So he didn't really know what to do with me. But I did start attending Mass in prison, for the first time, and that was a very, very significant and important step.
By the way, when they do option your book here, Race with the Devil, and do the biopic, I would choose the young Richard Harris to play your role. What do you think? Is that good? You like that?
I like that. I don't know how we're going to make Richard Harris young again, but yeah. but if you can arrange for the miracle, I'm all in favor.
Well, in his youth, he would have been perfect to play this role because your whole story reminds me of what happened to British films in sort of the John Osborne period of British cinema, the late 60s and 70s.
Right.
They got gritty.
Yep.
And they got gritty in the way that you describe in your book, the way England was going through really tough changes, and especially in terms of its economy, its class structure, and the old guard was hanging on much to the detriment of of people who were not privileged, but at the same time, the old guard were the one that opened up the floodgates to all these immigrants, correct?
Right, exactly. So you had a crisis of identity in the UK in the 1960s and 1970s, and it was that, if you like, that sort of seismic shift that was going on that shook me up, and that was why I was in the position I was in. You know, what did it mean to be an Englishman in 1970s Britain? You know, well, for me, as a teenager, it meant basically being a white supremacist because, you know, we had to eradicate the non-white presence in the United Kingdom. Of course, I came to realize that if that is what being English is, then being English is being pernicious. It's not worth defending if that's what being English is. Of course, I don't believe that now. England is, you know, St. Edward the Confessor, St. Thomas More, William Shakespeare, and the things
right.
worthy.
That's
the England to which I now...
I hope you add Elgar to that list.
Elgar would be a worthy addition to that list.
Yes. Now, tell me you didn't have pictures of Hitler and Goering on the wall. Tell me you did. Did you?
As a young man, as a teenager, I admired Hitler. I admired Goebbels even more than I admired Hitler, but I actually grew out of the Hitlerism pretty quickly. I actually started supporting, subscribing to the ideas of the Strasser brothers. I don't know how much you know the history
yes.
of the Third Reich, but they were basically dissidents within the Nazi party who were opposed to Hitler. Gregor Strasser was murdered by Hitler on the night of the Long Knives, and
right.
Otto Strasser was forced into exile.
So you sort of found the version of it that you thought was respectable.
Well,
according to your lights at the
yeah,
time.
Exactly. Certainly not psychopathic. I mean, I think I began to realize that Hitler was largely mad. Of course, many of the things that he ordered and that were done in his name before and during the Second World War were not really defensible from any ethical standpoint. So, yeah, I was looking for a position to hold that was not as psychopathic.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a really tough question.
Please.
You read about Hitler as a young man. You were, as you describe it yourself right now, a racist. How did you feel about the Holocaust during that period of your life?
Well, I was very much what is now called a Holocaust denier. I mean, I read books such as Did 6 Million Really Die and The Hoax of the 20th Century, and I believed that the Holocaust was basically a bogus work of post-war propaganda. So
you really believe that?
Absolutely, because I read the books and I didn't know my history, and you know what else do you have to go on? You know, you have to understand is that for the first several years that I was in the National Front, the only books I read were basically works of racist ideology and history.
Yeah, so you had nothing to compare it to.
Exactly.
And you didn't know what you didn't know.
Because I was ignorant of my ignorance.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's dangerous, you know.
I have found whenever I have dealt with folks who have kind of outlandish opinions, say, about Catholics, almost every time doesn't come down to any kind of hatefulness or meanness on their part, just the wrong information. They don't have the information that they need, or they trusted an authority figure who gave them, quote-unquote, the lowdown on Catholics.
Right. Well, what I always say, you know, is that the people that are anti-Catholic are not actually anti-Catholic. They're anti-something which isn't Catholic.
Right.
So it's an ignorant position, and they've set up basically, a shibboleth, which is not the real thing, and that's the thing they hate. Well, if they actually understood what Catholicism really was, they wouldn't hold that position.
So you're in your late teens, and you're writing... regularly editing, you're having success in terms of your mission at the time. Later on, you would become a very respected and, by the way, fairly so, reader of great books and texts and so forth. Did you have literary aspirations at this time, or was this all to come later?
Well, I mean, I always knew that writing, if you like, was a vocation. I made the finals of a national poetry competition when I was about 9 or 10 years old.
Wow. Okay.
I did very well at school.
And I noticed you published some poetry in the past 5 or 6 years.
I have. I published a slim volume of my own poems.
Right.
I don't unfortunately have time to indulge that passion very much. But You need time and space to write poetry, and I don't seem to have too much of that at the moment.
It'll come with time, believe you.
Please, God, you know. I always saw that I had a vocation as a writer, but of course, my writing for the most part has been nonfiction. When I was involved in politics, it was mostly agitational and propagandistic. I always had aspirations to write more seriously, and so that's, I suppose, if you like, the seeds were being planted even in those dark days for my book on Chesterton, which is my first full-length book following my conversion.
Have you gone back and read the pieces you wrote for The Bulldog and so forth? Have you actually gone back and read through them?
No. I don't actually possess. I mean, I possess. I wrote a biography, believe it or not, of a skinhead rock band called Screwdriver. And I still have that on my shelves for whatever reason.
Why don't you want to go back and read them?
First of all, I don't physically have them anymore, and I certainly don't want to read them badly enough to hunt them down. So
Well, all you have to do is ask the police. Evidently, they have them.
Yeah, well, I don't want to read them badly enough to go to that much trouble.
The interesting thing about, well, there's many interesting things about your journey, but you talk about rational love. That seems to be the leitmotif of this book and of your conversion. Where did you get the phrase rational love? Did you get it from a specific place, or did you just sort of take the Aristotelian Thomistic notion of love and work with it?
Well, the actual phrase, if I recall correctly, was fairly recently, about 3 years ago, in a conversation with Michael Pakulluk, who's
I know Michael. Yeah,
he's a professor at Ave Maria University, and he used the phrase rational love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were talking about my conversion, and he used the phrase, and I thought, that's good. And I don't think I've officially accredited him yet, so now I've done it officially on your program. So I think that was, the phrase comes from him. But yes, of course, it's very Aristotelian, very Thomistic. So it sort of summed up very succinctly what I was trying to get at. And I suppose that the
what's irrational about what you were doing before?
Well, the key element of my conversion, the two key elements, the one I recognized at the time was the connection between faith and reason. In other words, that the more that I understood what reason was and what being rational was, through reading people such as Chesterton and eventually Aquinas and others, that the faith and reason were inextricably connected. They were basically married. They were indissoluble. So there's that understanding, and of course the Christian understanding of love is that love is
wishing the good for another person.
But yeah, ultimately it's a commandment, and it's also an action. No, we have to lay down our lives for the other. So it's an act of sacrifice. And in the absence of that self-sacrificial choice, the choice is a rational choice. In the absence of that self-sacrificial choice, there is no love. So in other words, to talk about love in terms of feeling or passion or erotic desire or any other sort of desire is not truly love. That's an accidental quality, perhaps, of love, but it's not the essential ingredient of love, which is the choice to sacrifice oneself for the beloved, for the other.
Talking with Joseph Pierce, who's professor of humanities, writer in residence at St. Thomas More College in New Hampshire, I noticed, though, that you, in your book, you actually comment on a comment by C.S. Lewis about Chesterton, and C.S. Lewis himself was born in Belfast. C.S. Lewis himself, it is argued by Christopher Derrick, for example, never became a Catholic because of his anti-Catholicism. Did you ever pick up on that?
Well, yes, actually. I mean, I wrote a book with C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, taking up from Christopher Derrick.
From Derrick, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I forgot that.
No, that's fine.
I apologize. You've just written so many books, I can't remember them all.
Well, I'm pleased I've written so many that it's impossible to keep up with them. Yeah, but obviously Christopher Derrick wrote a book called C.S. Lewis and the Church of Rome, and I wrote a book called C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, which is taking up the cudgels that Christopher Derrick sort of had taken up earlier, but taking it further and maybe in slightly different directions. But, yeah, I agree ultimately, if you have to sum up why Lewis never became a Catholic in a nutshell, then you could say the most succinct way it was ever put was by J.R.R. Tolkien, who said when he was asked why Lewis never became a Catholic, he laughed and said the ulterior motive. Exactly. You know, in other words, the fact that he was an Ulster Protestant was too much.
And the fact is, he did not have what I would call a Catholic sensibility. Do you agree?
Yeah, largely. But I think that, you know, he never fully understood the medieval. There's a wonderful essay, I think, by David Lowell Jeffrey in a book called Reading the Classics with C.S. Lewis, about Lewis the Medievalist, where
right.
it's made perfectly clear he doesn't understand the medieval mind. He doesn't understand the devotion to the Blessed Virgin. These are significant blocks.
He's much better on the Renaissance.
He is, exactly. Much better on the Renaissance, yeah.
And that because it's parallel to the Reformation, I suppose, but
yeah, he's more comfortable with that period. He can pick and choose more safely. The medieval steeped in Catholicism, he has to have a willful blindness to actually, you know, miss some of the should we say integrated faith and reason, which involves, you know, devotion to the Blessed Virgin. He has a residual reaction against those things.
You know, the only other book that I know that takes this issue head on, I mean, other than some of the old books about people overcoming their problems with African Americans, is a novel by Francine Prose entitled A Changed Man. Do you know that novel?
Not in the least, I'm afraid.
It's a novel about a skinhead who ends up going to a Holocaust survivor and trying to convince him that he has converted, that he has changed. It's a very interesting book and parallels a lot.
That's a fairly recent
your work.
Is it? Fairly recent?
It's about 10 years ago. Francine Prose, a novelist, Italian-American. It's quite good. I think you'll like it.
I should check that out.
I am talking with Joseph Pierce about the things we both love best, books, literature, but we're also talking about his most recent book about his conversion from race hatred. It's entitled Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. And we will be back with Joseph Pierce just after this message.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. Ave Maria radio host Sister Ann Shields will give a Lenten reflection Saturday, April 12th at Immaculate Conception Church in Milan. The reflection is titled Prayer as an Expression of Love. The reflection is free and open to the public, men, women, and youth, confirmation age and up. To reserve your seat, contact the parish office at 734-439-2030. Don't miss the Homeschool Connection Thespian staging of Oscar Wilde's The Ideal Husband, April 10th through the 12th at Whitmore Lake High School. This witty comedy takes you to 18th century London. Family rates are available by pre-order only. To reserve your tickets, call 734-484-3497. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, we begin Great Week, the week of the Bridegroom, where we unite our passion and suffering with that of Christ. This is especially true for the Eastern Christian churches and faithful of Ukraine.
Saturday evenings at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
I'm talking with Joseph Pierce, who's professor of humanities and writer in residence at Thomas More College, New Hampshire. We're talking about the latest of his many books, most of them on Catholic writers, Catholic poets, Catholic historians, Shakespeare, his EWTN specials, that is, videos on Shakespeare and an ongoing series on J.R.R. Tolkien. We're talking about his book, Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. Now, what I'd like to ask, Joseph, is along the way, other than reading, were there any people, were there any girlfriends or anybody else who sort of beat you over their head and said, you got to stop this?
Well, there were girls. They certainly didn't help me in my progress.
they were on the team, huh?
They were on the team. They were at best, they were distractions from the bad things I was doing. At worst, they were accomplices. But what I do talk about in my book is isolated incidents of love by enemies. When people whom I consider to be my enemies, instead of hating me, I mean, to me it was very simple. You hated your enemies, you worked to destroy your enemies, very Nietzschean, very anti-Christian. And that was my attitude towards my enemies, and that was the way, of course, most of my enemies treated me. Certainly the extreme left, the Trotskyites, their philosophy was very simply to crack my skull if they could. So that was very simple. You just hate your enemy. So, but what's very disarming and was very, very, I think, important on my own progress towards conversion were the isolated incidents of love that I received. So, I gave a few examples in my book of those. To give just one, I approached the UK equivalent of the ACLU. It was called the National Council for Civil Liberties, but it's the UK equivalent of the ACLU, because we had been imprisoned illegally by the police in a convoy of buses en route to a demonstration, and clearly that they'd run roughshod over the law. And I went to these civil liberties lawyers, believing that they would just tell me to go to hell, just so that I could win a propaganda point that these people are hypocrites. They believe in civil liberties for people they agree with, but not for their enemies, in which case they're no better than anybody else. So it was just a propaganda ploy. But I went there, and I spoke to a Jewish American, and I was anti-American and anti-Semitic.
Very interesting story. Go ahead.
He was obviously probably certainly left-wing, maybe a Marxist, but certainly an American Jew. So here am I, an anti-American, an anti-Semite, and somebody who doesn't like the left-wing opinion. And I'm going to this person, laying out my complaint, and expecting him to say, well, you're a fascist, what do you expect? And he agreed with me sympathetically and agreed to support our civil liberties suit against the police. But then I was subsequently proved right because his colleagues refused to support him and said we can't support those people, they're fascists. But this person resigned his job
principle.
And I thought, wow, that person has sacrificed his job for me, who's an enemy of him, of his ideologically, because he believes in principle in the idea of civil liberties. And by this time, I'd read George Orwell, and I was against, and also was the recipient of Big Brother's iron fist tactics. So I was turning against Big Brother. I was turning against totalitarianism. And you see this civil liberties lawyer practicing what he preaches and losing his job for doing so. And that was a practical example of rational love. He didn't do that towards me because he felt fuzzy towards me. He did it because it was the right thing to do.
Have you stayed in touch with him?
Alas, I didn't stay in touch with him, and I don't even remember his name, which is a great shame because it makes it impossible to track him down unless by some miracle he reads the book.
You got to find this guy. You really do.
I would love to. Well,
I mean, it's a matter of piety. You got to go back and find this guy.
I probably contact the National Council for Civil Liberties and ask the list of the employees from the mid-70s, or late-70s.
You can find him.
Well,
I think that would be a really wonderful reunion for you to have. I know that I say that because I'm a little older than you are, but I've gotten to the point where I've gone to the trouble of finding some people who were crucial in my life and were helpful and forgiving and life-changing. And so I've gone, I found them. And, of course, with Facebook and all these other things, it's not so hard to find people anymore.
Right. Well, that's true.
So, by the way, if somebody wanted to be in touch with you, let's say some listener here is maybe suffers from this problem, and they feel like you might be able to help them, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I mean, they contacted me via Thomas More College in New Hampshire. That would be the best way. I'm not sure I actually want to give my email address out.
No, but they can call just the main line at Thomas More College.
If they go via Thomas More College, they will be able to track me down without any major problem. Certainly any messages will be passed on to me. And I'm inspired by C.S. Lewis to always try to reply to any emails that
I
see. So I will respond if people do want to contact me. Via Thomas More College of the Liberal Arts in New Hampshire.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to this book so far? And, have you done any – you must have done some public events. Have you gotten beaten up for it yet?
Well, not really, actually. For most of the people I've spoken to on this and the talks I've given – I've been to Christian audiences, Catholic and Protestant, and it's been overwhelmingly positive. I've had a handful of, should we say, former comrades of mine from my past contact me, but even those, for the most part, with one or two exceptions, have been positive, including people from my past who have themselves converted to Catholicism. So my past is not a unique one. I'm pleased to say that there are people that even as were as full of hatred as I was that have found the love of Christ and his church. Of course, there are also the odd nasty, threatening one. I know there's some very horrible things being said about me on the web in some of these.
You too, huh?
Right.
I mean, it's kind of – the web has just become the kind of garbage dump of human communication, I think.
Exactly. I mean, com boxes are just full of vitriol. I mean, it's almost harmful to the soul to even read.
That's why they call them trolls.
Right, exactly.
Well, you haven't actually received any serious threats, though, correct?
No, not death threats, it's not that. No.
How is it, your wife, Susanna, how does she look at you sort of exposing yourself like this? Does she have any hesitation about it?
No, she's been absolutely wonderfully supportive of me and throughout all the years of our marriage. She's just been great. I don't even know how to express that adequately. It's not often that the deal that you're going to ask me a question that renders me speechless, but when you ask me to pay due compliments to my wife, you virtually do that. I don't even know how to thank her. You know?
Well, that's believe me, been there, done that. I'm talking with Joseph Pierce about his latest book, Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. That is overcoming a racial hatred as a young man in England. Now, do you ever find yourself entertaining those feelings of hatefulness and of prejudice? Do you ever find them, does something come into your field of vision that sort of pops them up again?
Well, I would say that now the answer to that is no. But certainly, if you'd asked me that maybe 10 or 15 years ago, in other words, after my conversion, I think I'd probably have to say yes, because the other aspect of my conversion that I was not aware of at the time, which I'm very much aware of now, is the working of grace specifically in terms of healing.
Yes.
And sort of there's an aspect of racism which is not rational at all, and therefore merely coming to understand the connection between faith and reason, and coming to Christian conversion through the use of reason, is obviously important and a very 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 crucial part of my conversion process. But there's an aspect of it which was not rational, and my racism was not rational. And what was necessary there was healing. And so there's a healing process going on, and that continued to carry on, after my conversion. And, of course, there's a healing process going on in me now, and there will be, please God, until the day I die. But as regards, the actual racism, I think I can say now that is not really an issue with me. I mean, I have other sinful issues, but not specifically that.
But that one's sort of been burned out of you.
I think so, please God, and thank God.
What goes on inside of you when you all of a sudden are faced with someone who has that kind of hatred and is expressing it?
Well, of course, on one level, there's an element of empathy, because I know where he's coming from, because I was there. And in that, it's the same sort of way I imagine, if you come across someone who's a thief or whatever, if you've been a thief yourself, then you can understand where they're coming from. So in that sense, it's an element of empathy. So I don't treat them as some sort of abomination, the wholesome position that's so so impossible for me to comprehend, therefore I could do nothing but run in horror from it. So there's an element of empathy, but of course, you know, there's also an element of sympathy in the sense of not sympathizing with, but feeling sorry for. The fact that they are encumbered with this bitterness and negativity and ultimately irrationality, which is preventing them from coming to the fullness of truth and the fullness of love. And unless that is addressed and ultimately healed, that person's never going to be able to grow. That's why this image from the Lord of the Rings of Gollum is so, so powerful. If we allow certain sins to canker our heart, to become addicted to them, then our souls will shrivel. And it's certainly true of lust. It's true of, you know, allowing ourselves to become addicted to lust, whether it's pornography or whatever. But it's certainly also true of hatred and other forms of bigotry and bitterness. And if we don't address those issues, that our souls will be shriveled and we'll golemize ourselves.
Talking with Joseph Pierce about his book on overcoming racism, you know, Joseph, it seems to me that a lot of people, especially those, say, of my generation, can relate to your book in terms of growing up in a segregated society, which I did in Texas and so forth. I mean, I grew up in a society where African Americans went to one school, lived in one part of town, and I lived in another. And so anyone of my generation, I think anywhere, frankly, I don't think racism was in any way limited to the South or to the Southwest, had to go through a similar process. It may not have been as dramatic, but there were a lot of attitudes and a lot of language that had to be changed. Has anyone talked to you about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that it's in the United States. Obviously, I don't understand it from an interior point of view because I wasn't living here at the time. But it's quite clear there are distinct parallels between my experience growing up in England in the 70s and the experience growing up in the 60s and 70s in the United States. That racism was endemic. It was an integrated part of the collective psyche of the culture. So of course there's a process that the nation has been going through. We're coming to terms with that, and I think, you know, for all of my absolute opposition to progressivism, you know, there is something about the civil rights movement that was necessary, and growing pains that are coming from that, and we have to learn to defend tradition from the perspective of love. And if we can't do that, then the tradition we want is not worth loving.
You know, for me, it was actually a book by John Howard Griffin, Not Black Like Me, which is his famous book.
Right. We read that at school. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time,
but a book called, I think it was called Structures of Prejudice.
Okay.
Which really sort of rooted out in me the last vestiges of my, you know, my upbringing.
Right.
And it really put an exact kind of definition on how to know if you are prejudiced or not. And I, you know, when I read John Howard Griffin, the famous Catholic convert, novelist, you know, he wrote Black Like Me, which was made into a movie, it got to me. And I think it kind of burned that last vestige of it out of me, the way you're describing, having had that burned out.
Yeah. And it was necessary, of course. Painful, growing, because they're growing pains. We have to grow out of that darkness into the light. And you know, as with most types of growth, there's a suffering attached. And so we needed that pain, we need to come through it, and we need to go beyond it. And that's what we obviously do as Catholics, as part of what we are, is to love our neighbors. But, you know, but there, I think it's a bigger problem in the wider so-called conservative movement. And that's, you know, something that has to be addressed and confronted.
It seems to me, though, that the very, let's call it an ideology of prejudice that you overcame coming into the Catholic Church, this seems to be popping up all over again, all around the world, especially in France. How do you account for that?
Well, I think that modernity is in meltdown. And because modernity is in meltdown, we're going to have a growth in hatred. and hatred in all sorts of terms. The nihilistic hatred that we see at the heart of liberalism now, and the culture of death, to use John Paul II's words, but also, you know, the ethnic hatred, so the hatred of Muslims for European culture, the hatred of whites within Europe, of Islam, the rise of
attitude. You definitely see it when it comes to attitude toward Muslims.
Let me give you a practical example here. This is also another episode that I talk about in my book. I returned home to England. My parents have relatively recently passed on, but when they were still alive, I went back to England from the United States and was on the tube in London, getting a tube west. I was changing trains, and these two Pakistanis walked up to me, and one of them said, "Are you Joe Pierce?" And I thought, you know, because of my past, that this was going to be some sort of confrontational situation. So I braced myself for the worst and said, yes. And this chap said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I thought to myself, "Well, I don't know any Pakistanis." So and I didn't say that, but that's what I thought. And he said, he gave his name. I won't give his name, but he gave his name. And I realized he was the one Pakistani that I had as a friend at school. And he was a secular person at the time. And he was the first person to show me pornographic magazines behind the bike shed, literally that scenario. And now he said to me that you and I have a lot in common. So I thought, well, what do you mean? Obviously, as school friends. But and he said, well, you hate the Jews, and so do I. And what I found really bizarre.
Oh, he hadn't kept up with current events.
He'd become an Islamicized fanatic.
Yes.
And his Islamic fundamentalism. Now, made him want to be an ally with a neo-Nazi because his hatred of Israel was bigger than his obviously dislike of racism, which was, I found, bizarre. But I also saw as a microcosmic example of what had happened in the UK with the polarization of communities, because the Islamic community in England is very, very hostile to the indigenous culture, and of course that feeds the racism that's already there in the indigenous culture towards non-whites. So you have the two extremes feeding off each other and fermenting mutual hatred. It's a very, very unhealthy situation.
By the way, you just put your finger on what it was in the book by John Howard Griffin that struck me, and that is the disposition toward having your prejudices corroborated by anybody, fitting that description or under that group, whether it's African American or Hispanic or whatever, who happen to do the things that you believe they always do.
Right.
And it's that willingness to see it constantly corroborated.
Exactly. It's the reinforcement of stereotype and prejudice. So it's selective looking at the facts. If a black man behaves well and charitably, you ignore it. In fact, you feel uncomfortable by it. But as soon as you see one that's committed some crime that fits your prejudice, then you accentuate and exaggerate that in your own mind. So that remains the picture.
See how they act that way, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's no real effort, either consciously or subconsciously, to see an objective picture. All you want is your prejudice and your stereotypes to be reinforced all the time.
That's very important for people to look at in themselves. That where they never, it's sort of an unrefutable position. You know, they have a prejudice, and they never notice any evidence to the contrary. They only notice evidence that supports the prejudice.
Exactly. There's a willful blindness. And that's why I said in my book, when there were examples of people that I considered to be my enemies showing me love, that was the most disarming thing of all. And the thing that was most powerful in undermining my own position was actually for people to show me love when I expect them to hate me. So again, what we need is to be open to our prejudices being questioned. And once we are open to that, and obviously in a spirit of love, which is what is ultimately what animates anything worthwhile, then we will come to see that perhaps some of our own opinions are actually rooted not in objectivity, but in a subjective bias.
Talking with Joseph Pierce about his book on overcoming race hatred called Race from the Devil, but Joseph, it's entirely possible that when that person who you went to, sort of in bad faith, actually, showed you respect, it's entirely possible that you would not have noticed it or not have seen it for what it was. You would have just scorned him.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why there has to be, if you like, seeds of grace at work to make us receptive. And, of course, we can remain willfully blind. We can reject the seeds of faith. We have to be open. And I thank God that, you know, that on those examples where people did show me love, it confused me at first, I admit. You know, and I was uncomfortable by it. This wasn't the response I was expecting. And up to a point, I put it out of my mind at the time, but it was there. It was in the back of my head or the back of my heart or wherever these things reside. and it was there as a seed which continued to grow. And I realized, you know, that particularly when I came to write this book, I'd been haunted by these examples of rational love, of people making a conscious choice to sacrifice themselves for me, even though I was an enemy. And how valuable that was in my own progress towards love myself.
I was touched by your comments about your father. Talk a little bit about your relationship with your father through this period of change.
Yeah, well, the hardest thing about writing the book was to get to grips with my father, and one of the reasons that I procrastinated so long about writing the book was because of my relationship with my father. I basically had an extremely good relationship with my father, a very loving relationship with my father, and he probably, under grace, is the single biggest influence on my life. But that was for good and for ill. I mean, my love of Shakespeare, my love of literature, my love of all that is good in history and in culture, I get from him. My experience of love, my mother as well, of course, I get from him. But also, I got my prejudices from him. You know, he was anti-Catholic. He was a racist. He was anti-Semitic. He did admire Hitler. So
you had a Mel Gibson sort of dad, or is that how it is?
Yeah, well, I don't know much about Mel Gibson sort of dad. I don't want to sit in judgment on him.
Well, it's a matter of public record. So
well, yeah, I know. I know, but, you know, absolutely. So there's a... I picked up prejudices from my father as well as many, many good things. He was an autodidact. He left school at the age of 14 because of the Second World War.
Right.
He was evacuated twice from London. So he had a very disruptive education. Yeah, he was an autodidact and taught himself so much. So I have so much to be grateful for. And yet, you know, a lot of my conversion was, if you like, undoing some of the prejudices which I had really sort of learned at my father's knee. So it was a difficult aspect of the book, but one which, if I were to endeavor to be honest, I couldn't shun. So I had to get to grips with it and tackle it.
But it sounds like he laid by introducing you to great books, he also gave you the tools to find the way out.
Absolutely. I mean, he was through my father, the love of learning, the love of history, the love of literature, the love of reading. And that, of course, it was that those loves that were the tools, as you rightly say, that enabled me to escape from my prejudice. And I should say as well, you know, my father himself converted to Catholicism and spent the last 10 years of his life as a Catholic. So, you know, he also unlearned the prejudices that he'd inherited himself from the culture in which he'd grown up. So, you know, both of us, if you like, grew up together and grew in love together for Catholicism and for Christ and his church.
That's a wonderful... I'm glad I asked about your dad, because I knew that the answer might be what you just gave, and that is the most important influence and also the most emotionally charged part of the book has to do with your father.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Please God, I've handled it well. The feedback I get, most people seem to think that no one is standing in condemnation towards my father. They see that he's a complex character.
All our fathers were complex. I'll tell you right now.
And that's what I hope, is that perhaps that the readers of the book will see something of their own.
As we will be seen by our own children. I'm talking with Joseph Pierce, professor of humanities, writer in residence at St. Thomas More College in New Hampshire, about his recent book, Race with the Devil: My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. I urge all of our listeners to find it and read it share it. Joseph, thanks for being a guest on Church and Culture.
My pleasure as always, Bill. God bless you.
As we close, I want to thank each of you for listening. I hope you found it as enjoyable as I have in bringing it to you. Join me again next week on Church and Culture, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
I'm Vanessa Denha Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. My journalistic integrity was questioned when I approached a story about 40 days of life and did not include what the accuser thought was a balanced view from the other side. The issue was that the other side didn't want to go on the record. See, there's a price to pay for speaking truth. But what is truth? The Bible teaches us that murder is wrong. The unborn is a person. Just read the Gospel of Luke. For behold, when the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby leaped in my womb for joy. And in Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I've appointed you a prophet to the nations. Therefore, we know it is wrong to murder the unborn. Yet, I'm still attacked for standing by the Word of God. So what would Jesus say today when the majority do not agree with me for defending Scripture? He would say, speak truth anyway. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha Garmo, a communication evangelist.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Our archive talk this week is by author and conference speaker Steve Ray.
How then shall the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen this way? In other words, I've chosen this from the beginning. It's prophesied in the Old Testament. I struggled and wept drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane, resolving this in my human will that I was going to do this. I'm resolved. I could call 72,000 angels at this moment and wipe Jerusalem off the map. Pontius Pilate says, don't you know I have the power to crucify you or let you go? Jesus knew he had no such power.
The pain, the agony, the self-sacrifice of himself on the cross for us. For our Easter program, Steve Ray orally demonstrates for us the physical aspects of the agony Christ went through to redeem us from our sins. Join us Sunday afternoons at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, Chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
On Palm Sunday, we remember Jesus entering the Holy City on the week he was crucified. You probably know the story because we get long readings and processions every year. Some churches even use a live donkey. I never have, they make a mess. He's escorted to Jerusalem by an enthusiastic crowd shouting Hosanna. But the Jerusalem religious authorities hated him and plotted to crucify him. Now what's the meaning of all this? The blessed Apostle Paul gives the answer. Christ became obedient for us, even to death on the cross. Therefore, for that reason, God raised him on high and gave him a name above all other names. And he did all this for us. That's St. Paul's explanation. Christ Jesus did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, to hang on to. Rather, he emptied himself, coming in human.